thought it would be easier just to put some of these things on paper and let you look as we dig in a little bit. It really defies just a straight lecture aspect and note-taking, so I hope this is useful. I want to say how much I appreciate being invited, not only to participate, but just to be in attendance. It was regrettable last year. I wasn't able to come. A number of our students from Southwest were in attendance, and they all came back with very positive, glowing reports of this program, and I'm glad this year that I'm able to be a part of it and be in attendance through the days this week. One day a little boy in Bible class was asked by his teacher if he could tell a little bit about the affairs that took place with the departure of Egypt, from Egypt, of the Israelites. And so this little boy thought for a moment. He said, well, he said the Egyptians were all drowned in the sea as the Israelites went out into the desert. Afterwards, Moses went up on Mount Sinai and he got there the Ten Amendments from God. Well, the teacher chuckles a little bit. Some of those words, they didn't go into a desert, they went into a desert. It may have occasionally seemed like Moses took Sinai from some of the things that he had to deal with the Israelites, but he didn't receive the amendments, of course, he received the commandments. Interesting how important the words are, the individual words that God uses to talk about his great message to us and to all people. My intentions for today and tomorrow are these. This morning I'd like to talk a little bit about the general use of word studies, how they can be performed, some things to bear in mind for a person who's going to be responsible and careful in handling God's Word. And then I'd like to look at some examples that are drawn from Old Testament texts this morning. My aim tomorrow morning is to turn attention primarily to examples from the New Testament, things that I hope are clarifications or helpful in our study of New Testament passages, maybe some elements that we can work into our preaching or our teaching as the opportunity presents itself. I am, and I confess this in a somewhat nerdy fashion, I am a student of language and literature. And thinking about talking about gerunds and participles and all that, just it really makes me happy. So I confess that I'm a language geek in a way. But in all of that kind of study, I've come to the conclusion that God really is a master wordsmith. And that when he put his thoughts through inspired writers, into the hearing of and then the reading through writings of the texts of the scriptures, that God was very, very careful with the things that he said. And that means that I as a reader, you as a reader, need to be very careful about the things that we see and how we draw from those and then prepare to communicate them to others as well. One of the most important passages, I think, is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, beginning in verse number 9. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9. And Paul says there, as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for them that love him. But God has revealed them unto us by his Spirit, for the Spirit searches all the things, yea, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God knows no man but the Spirit of God. In simple terms, Paul says that our insides know what we are thinking. It is only when they get expressed that someone else is given insight. The reason he mentions that is found in the following two verses. Now we have received not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us by God, which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. It is worth noting, in my opinion, that God has a language that he speaks. It is not a foreign language in the sense that it is outside of human beings. But with our words, the things that human beings used in the days in which God's spokesmen were at work, he had concepts, ideas, and principles that he wanted to make clear for people to have thought patterns that replicated those in the divine mind, a vocabulary that replicated that of the divine mind. And that means that I'm benefited when I begin to look more deeply into the ways that God has communicated the riches of his great and revealed message. I think this is perfectly indicative of Psalm 1. The blessed man is the one who loves the law of the Lord, and he meditates upon it day and night. That meditation is not a clearing of the mind, like Eastern religions and modern thought might trend to do. It is instead a filling of the mind with God's words, his message, and then a meditating and thinking deeply upon what the meanings would be, what their applications would be, and how they would help or shape our lives to be conformed with God's expectations. That's Bible meditation. It's very heavily oriented, obviously, toward the issue of wrestling with God's texts. I want to begin, and you'll notice there's a certain compartmentalizing as we go through parts of this, and set something of a background before the examples. A couple of general observations about word studies. I do not personally look at word studies as a way into some hidden theology or some secret esoteric type of learning available only to certain initiated ones. I don't think that's true. And I would also caution us and myself to be wary of individuals who claim to have dug through a few key words and come up with a novel teaching or a word of truth that serious Bible students and serious exegetes have never seen before. Now, that's not to say that there aren't valuable things that can be uncovered, but I am cautious when someone suggests that they've found something so revolutionary as to change the way we look at all the things that we know from the Scriptures. On the other hand, there are riches to be mined that evade our attention if we just look at a surface level or a casual perusal. And I know that this morning we have a variety. By the way, I'm glad to see the wives and kids and others who are here. I really am. Elders. But I do speak primarily to preachers of the gospel, the Bible class teachers this morning, with the things that I bring out. And you and I are the ones who will help open up for others as well these riches and this deep appreciation for the things that God has to say. I do note here in the middle of the first page, I recognize that very few people today would be considered masters of the ancient languages in which the Bible texts were composed, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. I am not one of those persons, okay, and most are not going to be. But one of the great benefits that we have is that more than any other generation, I think, our time sees the greatest proliferation or availability of teaching materials to help us wrestle with the languages, to make the original texts and writings, the manuscripts, accessible to us. It doesn't mean that we need to become an expert in Greek or Hebrew. But it does mean that there are tools we can utilize, and with some basic or rudimentary learning, there are certain options that become very accessible for us. And that's worth investing in, both the time and the energy, as well as having the materials. One other thing I'll mention as we kind of get started, you may have heard of texts like Robertson's Word Pictures, or Vincent's Word Studies, or others like that. And I'm going to ask if everybody's got a copy of the handout that we're working through. I know that there were quite a few made, so I want to make sure everybody... We'll depend upon this very heavily, so that's why I mention it. Okay. Wayne will want one. Okay. When you think about these word studies, very often you might look in such a text, perhaps you've done so in the past, and you'll think, you know, this is just so helpful in making something become a bit more clear or help me to appreciate some significance more fully. I would encourage us, however, to be careful about the theological biases, the tendencies of these writers, most of whom are not members of the church. And so the same type of cautions should be in place with us as when looking at commentaries written by denominational authors and things. On the other hand, they can be very good, and it's worth taking the time to investigate. If I could make a suggestion, if the Brotherhood is going to say that we could use better materials, better reference materials, or resources of this type, then it's going to be people like us who are going to have to author such texts. Okay? It's not going to come from the Brotherhood in general, because they're not going to have the level of learning that's necessary in most cases. It will come from preachers or, you know, serious Bible students who've invested time and energy to learn and to produce things. And if I could say something to this generation and future ones, if we want good, faithful, and seriously capable works, we are the ones and our colleagues are going to have to produce such things. And it's worth setting that as a goal. I remind our students of that at Southwest. Not everyone may love these languages as much as I do. But someone may feel the need and have the opportunity to help invest themselves in producing these types of works, and they're worth producing. Where do you begin? Somebody says, well, I want to start a word study and I don't know what to do. I don't know where to dig. I've tried to provide a few guidelines suggested by authors that I have found helpful and some complimentary statements that I thought would be helpful. Where do we begin? You'll find here at the bottom of page one a list of suggestions by Daryl Bach, not a member of the church, but he does have some good suggestions in a text called Introducing New Testament Interpretation, and his focus is on New Testament word analysis. Now, several of the sources I will mention have New Testament in the beginning of their titles, but the principles they talk about are going to be true for both old and new. One of the things that he suggests is that we could choose any words, of course, where the English definition is unclear. And that may seem a bit simple. We would expect that. Of course, he's writing to whatever audience. But if there's a word that we don't understand or its meaning is less than clear for us, then that obviously is going to merit attention just for a general responsibility in handling the text. Another source, he says, is that if we find words that appear to be synonyms or antonyms, and we wonder, well, are they really so equivalent or are they not? Those are places we want to dig a little bit before we start saying, well, they are simply redundant or repetitive, or maybe we lose some real distinctions because we've jumped too hastily to the thought that they're equivalent. Number three, words that are used only once, maybe once or twice, in the canon or in a book can become very important. Why that word? Why here? And is there some significance to it? Number four, perhaps figures of speech. It could be a parable. It could be an illustration, a metaphor, or something like that. It could be worth digging a little bit more deeply. Number five, the most crucial words are those that are either repeated because repetition thought to mean something significant, or that clearly bear the weight of a passage. If it's a conversation talking about what love really means, then clearly that word is going to be worth investigating. Another set of suggestions, very similar, from Gordon Fee. He says, number one, make a list of words known beforehand or recognizable by content to be theologically loaded. How about the word grace? How about the word baptism? It doesn't always mean the same exact thing in every encounter or every instance. It always means submersion, but in what? Well, that's to be determined by context, for example. He also says that we should make note of words that make a difference in the meaning of the passage, but again, might be ambiguous or unclear. Note repeated words or motifs. And number four, be alert for words that may have more significance than might at first appear. I'd like to offer a suggestion to these as well. Probably in your library you have a number of different Bibles, English Bibles. And I would suggest that maybe you take something like your King James Bible, an American Standard, a New American Standard, or a Revised Standard, something like that. And it may involve words that you wouldn't generally feel comfortable using, but the reason I suggest taking them is because when you have a passage that you're investigating, you might find that the wording differs between those translations, and those differences may suggest that the translator has made some decisions about how to render a key turn. And that may be a very point where you would like to wrestle a little bit with what the text says, maybe that's behind the English. In other words, that's just a way of sort of bringing to the front or surfacing the terms that really merit further consideration because they show some differences between those English translations. All right. Let's suppose that you've already decided what you want to do. You're thinking, what things do I need to take into account when I begin my word study? And I've provided another list, this time from Buckley Nicholson's text, Interpreting the Bible. I found that actually quite helpful because it talks about other things like figures of speech, language aspects, a number of different items. And so it is a helpful text, I think. When we start looking at a word to define it and think about how it integrates with our Bible studies or would be preaching and teaching, we know, first of all, words often have more than one meaning. And that means that you and I have to be careful to make sure we take into account the context in which the word is found. Which leads us to the second point is, words do not exist in a vacuum. They have meaning in relationship to the words that surround them. So if you take the word right, R-I-G-H-T, what does that word mean? Someone says, well, the opposite of left. That's correct. Someone says the opposite of untrue or incorrect. That's also true, and those are not equivalent. It's because the word has a meaning dependent upon the context in which it is found. In addition, I remind us that words can change meaning over time. I like reading dictionaries. It's kind of a strange thing. I probably should be medicated for it, but the Oxford English Dictionary has a reputation, well earned. It is the dictionary that tries to present the etymology or the history of a word's development and use for every English word. Well, I could get to looking into words that have these certain origins, and I could think, oh, wow, that's interesting. I should bring that into my study or my preaching or whatever. But I have this caveat, this warning. Words change meaning over time, which means that what they originally meant or how they were originally constructed may no longer be true of the meaning of the word. And that may be the case in the terms of the writing of Paul's words, for example. I'll show an example in a moment. If someone comes to you and says, man, you're silly, you're not usually going to take that as a compliment, right? But if you look at the origins of the word silly and its first meanings, the word enters the English language first and it means happy or fortunate. Well, that doesn't sound like the word I usually use. A little bit later it grew to mean happy, spiritually blessed, well-omened, spiritually innocent, or deserving of compassion. It's only more recently that the word silly has come to mean feeble-minded or foolish or the usual meanings that we associate with it. So it's important for us to be careful to know when and how a word is being used. So here are these five suggestions from Berkeley Mickelson when we talk about how to manage a text and a word that's found that's of interest to us. Number one, know all the possible meanings of the word in the period of its occurrence, which is what we just spoke about in terms of etymology. Number two, find the best meaning for the context. And as it points out, it's not simply enough to say, well, I like this meaning, it's the one that seems best to me, or I've heard that before. Something more substantive needs to be given as a reason why we would accept a certain word and its meaning for a context. Number three, you might take into account the situation of your hearers or your readers as you're a preacher or teacher of the gospel, and you want to help prohibit them from importing their own meanings into words so that it's called eisegesis, not exegesis, leading into the text our preferences and meanings instead of drawing what the writer put there. Number four, beware of all etymological, again, root origins of words, pronouncements. Beware of those that are not well supported by contemporary usage. If they've changed, that has to be taken into account. And number five, beware of fine distinctions of meanings in synonyms that are not supported by the context in which they're found. When synonyms are used, we ought to see how these synonyms are given and add force to the idea being conveyed. In other words, if a synonym really does show a slight distinction, that may be worth bringing out. But I would hate to make sermons out of words that really are simply repeating themselves in parallelism. For example, in the book of Psalms, as a poetic text, the book of Psalms has a great deal of parallelism. David could talk in Psalm 51 in verse 1 about his sin and his iniquity. They're synonymous. He's simply using these multiple clauses to reiterate the fact that he is burdened with the sin of wrongdoing before God, of course, allows and gives him a way for forgiveness. I'd like to give an example of some of the changes that take place. If you look in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 17, Paul talks about making music and melody in your heart, you know, and all of this. But one of the words that is found there is the word sorrow. Sorrow has a meaning prior to the times of the New Testament to pluck the strings of an instrument. And so it might be used of someone playing a zither, for example. But by the time Paul uses that word, its meaning has changed substantially, so that now it can be employed for someone who's simply singing without the accompaniment of an instrument. In other words, it's like plucking the strings of the heart, that's all. But if someone does not take that change in language into account, they do a disservice to Paul's writings in Ephesians 5 and verse 17. I want to remind us as well, the Bible serves as its own best commentary. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 1, Paul would say, if you then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God. Paul, what do you mean, if you then be risen with Christ? What is this risen-ness that you're referring to? Well, just prior in the letter, chapter 2 and verse 12, Paul talks about an individual who is buried with Christ in baptism, who's been raised with Christ, and has faith in the operation of God. So he's talking about someone not raised at the end of time, for example, but he's talking about someone who's raised in newness of life, they've been baptized into Jesus Christ. So his text helps supply meaning and insight into his own words. Finally, I'll notice this. Very often we come into the New Testament, and maybe the Old Testament as well, and we find words are given new meaning as they are used by God's people to advance God's system or God's plan. Let's say the New Testament plan of salvation and redemption. In Matthew chapter 19, for example, Jesus says that a person who marries someone who is ineligible commits adultery by marrying this person. That is an expansion upon the meaning of the word adultery, physical, spiritual, and the marriage of someone unqualified. When we get to the book of 1 Timothy, chapter number 3, for example, the word presbyteros is used. It's the word elder. The word elder had long been used in Greek-speaking world, and it simply meant someone who was older. Then in the context of Judaism, it might speak of an elder, say of a synagogue. But now by Paul's inspired pen, it is given new meaning when he talks about this new office within Christianity and the list of qualifications that attend to it. The same thing happens with the word diakonos there in chapter 3, the word deacon. Sometimes it's helpful, of course, to know texts that you can use that would be helpful as resources. And so I've listed at least three of them here for the Old Testament. We'll do more tomorrow for the New Testament. These are not written by members of the church. Again, I caution you just to be careful and not to swallow something. If it seems odd or unusual, check it out before accepting it and moving forward. Number one, the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament by Harris, Archer, and Walke. We actually require our students at Southwest to obtain this volume. It's two originally, I think, and the one now. I find it extremely helpful. It does not require knowledge of Hebrew, thankfully. It is coded to Strong's numbers, which are found in Strong's Concordance, very easy to use. But the entries are smaller, they're manageable, and they do give really good insight. And I've used this one very, very often. Along with it is William Wilson, the Wilson's Word Studies from the Old Testament. That one does require a bit of use of the Hebrew alphabet, but that's not impossible to learn. You don't have to know anything except, is that letter, match that letter, match that letter, oh, I've got the right word here. But his simple, straightforward definitions and his verse references to where these occurrences of a word are found are very helpful. And finally, there is the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. I guess that would be the NIDOTTE. Okay? It's a five-volume set. It operates not so much by looking up a word in dictionary order, alphabetical order, but by talking of theological concepts and the words that are operative in those themes. It is a bigger version, if you will, of the first one we mentioned. At the bottom, or the next section of that page, I'd like to suggest basically three areas in which your work on word studies can help your study, your teaching, and your preaching. The first is that it helps us to bring out theological concepts or a richness in words that may not be immediately apparent to us, to unpack, as it were, words that have significance. The second possibility is that we learn about key words that are associated with people, maybe names or characteristics. And then finally, it may be that we become aware of words that are repeated, used often. They help to move a story forward in a narrative passage. They may help to drive a conversation or a discussion on a particular topic or theme in an argument or discussion. And I'm going to give us examples of all three of these, and you can see how they might be incorporated into our various studies. The first example I'll give is this unpacking of a key word. The word is loving kindness. Now that word is going to be found in your English Bible, especially King James Version, a number of different times. But it translates this nice Hebrew word, chesed. Chesed, okay. If you start looking up this word chesed, it occurs 253 times in the Old Testament. 130 times, more than half, just in the book of Psalms. Folks, that's a lot of occurrences. And all of a sudden I think, well, maybe this is a very powerful word that God would employ it so often, or it would be used by figures that are recorded in the pages of the Old Testament narratives. It's worth noting, however, that loving kindness is only one word in English that could be used for this Hebrew word chesed that underlies that. And so now I have to start doing a mapping back from English. I know this English word, loving kindness, where did it come from? I map it backwards and realize, oh, there are a number of other English words that are supplied for this one Hebrew word as well. And I have sort of a constellation that I need to investigate. Don't be put off by that. Think of that as a great opportunity to investigate something that clearly has substance or meaning to it. Other words that are used include mercy, mercifuls, mercies, pity, kindness, kindly, loving kindnesses, good, goodness, goodliness, favor, tender mercies, and maybe even a few others less frequently. All of a sudden, loving kindness is not quite enough. There's a bigger idea behind all of these elements that's worth fleshing out. A couple of observations. First of all, we notice not every English word occurrence translates chesed. In other words, in English, the word mercy may be a translation of the Hebrew word chesed, but it might be a translation of other Hebrew words as well. So this mapping from one language back to the word of another language is very important to stay on top of. Number two, this word can mean a reciprocal type of arrangement between parties. For example, in 2 Samuel chapter 10, David and Jonathan, they talk about how you be good to me and my people, I be good to you and your people. They have this loving relationship. They have this concern for each other. It is reciprocated. It is also used by God in relationship to his people. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 6 in the Ten Commandments. He'll talk about what he will do in the face of faithfulness or even unfaithfulness. It's used as well, for example, in Deuteronomy to talk about this. So it can have the idea of an expectation from one party to another. But there are some places where there is no sense of formal arrangement. You do for me, I do for you, quid pro quo. For example, when Jonah is sent to Nineveh, Jonah 4 and verse 2, you remember Jonah got really mad because Nineveh was saved? And he's really upset with God. He was put out. He said, I knew if I went and they turned and repented, I knew you would forgive them. And I didn't want you to. Because you, God, are a kind God. You show kindness. That's a sense of goodwill and expectation for other people. And Jonah says that's the nature of God. And that's the word chesed. So when you and I show that same type of goodwill, favor, kindness to someone else, we're imitating this aspect of God's own character. Number two, cases where you have words or names that are associated with figures that help us to appreciate characteristics or qualities. Let's start with the name Jehovah itself, or Yahweh. It comes from the Hebrew tetragrammaton, as it's called. It's a four-letter word. We put in English the letters YHWH. The vowels, not originally known, but they are supplied later to give us our words, Yahweh, Jehovah. But it's curiously found in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, when Moses says, what is your name, so that I can tell my fellow Israelites who has sent me? And God says, I'm Yahweh. And that word seems to be linked to the verb for existing. And so what God says is, I am what I am. It's this statement of existence, especially in the presence of his creation and of his people. It is the single most common term used for God in the Old Testament. And it really shows a kind of relationship aspect with it as well, God's existence in the presence of those who are of attention to him. Then the Bible sometimes, on a few occasions, puts another word with it. So in Genesis chapter 22, verse 14, after Abraham has gone to offer Isaac on the sacrifice there, as a sacrifice, then God is seeing Abraham's committed aspect and says, you know, we'll do something different. He provides this ram in the thicket. And God is called, or the site is called, Jehovah Jireh. which means God sees or God will provide. God took notice of Abraham and Isaac and he saw to what they needed. And that speaks about a provisional aspect, the caring aspect of God's person. Or we might look forward at Exodus chapter 17, verse 15. As the Israelites have left Egypt, they're encountering Amalekites and others from fighting. God is my banner. Jehovah is my banner. And here's the sense of God leading his people and protecting them, caring for them. And then finally, in Judges chapter 6, you have Gideon, who is called to be one of the judges. The Bible says in chapter 6 that the Midianites have very heavily oppressed the people of Israel. They are extremely burdened under this. They're living in caves and dens. They do get to do some farming, but the Midianites allow that so they can steal the harvest. When the angel of the Lord appears to Gideon, Gideon says, "Why, God, have you let this happen? Have you forsaken us?" And of course, the real problem is the Israelites forsook God. But Gideon will learn as this process goes. He has to stand up against his father's religion in the incorporation of Baal. He has to stand against the people of his city who would like to kill him for his championing of God only. And in the midst of all of this chaos and oppression and self-inflicted trouble, there is this designation of God, Jehovah Shalom. And the word Shalom means peace. That designation is important because out of all the chaos that people inflict upon themselves, when they turn and they address themselves toward God and do that which is right, he is the only one who can provide peace for them. And so here is the name of God that signifies what he brings to his people. We also have names such as Nabal, which means fool, and when Abigail talks about her husband to David, Nabal had insulted David. That was extremely foolhardy. Abigail says, "My husband is aptly named. He's really quite a fool." And she ameliorates the problem and soothes David's intended response. We might look at Jeremiah. The very name means the one whom God has appointed. And if you read the beginning of the book of Jeremiah, he talks much at length about how God appointed him. Or Micah, who is like God? And if you read the account of the book of Micah, you'll see that the nation of Israel has forgotten God, they're engaged in social abuses and problems, difficulties, and Micah is like a conscience calling them back to faithfulness. It's as if his own name reflects the very thing he sought to achieve in the people, which is this return to being like God and being like his people. So the names of the prophets oftentimes are very important or worth spending time to investigate. Prophet. The word prophet, there are several words that come to be used over time, but it has the idea of one who speaks on behalf of another. It is true God would point to an individual and say, "I want you to speak to these people." But we often hear the word prophet or prophecy. Our common conception is that people think about speaking the future, foretelling future events. There is a little bit of that that's true, but that's not the lion's share of what a prophet did. A prophet was a person who was given a message by God and asked to teach it, maybe educate the people, point out problems, tell them how to turn and make things better, suggest the ways that things will go well, but they spoke often to their contemporaries, much like a preacher might do today, or an elder. We're told in 1 Samuel chapter 10, for example, that there are schools of prophets, and you think, wow, how could you train someone to get these divine messages from God? But if we stop for a moment and think that a prophet really was a communicator of God's truths, is it possible to train a person to speak something that God had already revealed and which was being passed on by the one to whom it was revealed? And now you have a company of prophets, and I can't help but think about preaching schools or places where men and women learn what God has had to say through some inspired spokesman, but their responsibility is to be a herald. And that has connections with the work that you and I are engaged in as we present the gospel to the world. The last example is taken from the book of 2 Samuel chapter 11. You can turn there if you would like, but I put the details here. This is the third example that I gave where the repetition of a word can help carry a conversation or an idea forward. Wayne, how long? Do I have 2 minutes? Okay, that's enough. Chapter 11 of this chapter is David's terrible sin with Bathsheba and his arrangement for the death of her husband Uriah. The key word that's important here is the word send, in Hebrew shalach. But you don't even have to know that. If you just look and see the occasions of the word send, in chapter 11, it occurs 10 times. That's a lot of sending. I've listed for us all the back and forth. We'll just take note quickly. David sends his troops out to battle, verse 1. He stays home. He catches sight of Bathsheba, lets his gaze linger when he shouldn't have, and then he sends to find more information about her, verse 3. He then sends for her personally. They come, they lay together, and commit to sin, verse 4. Well, Bathsheba sends back to David and says, uh-oh, we're expecting a child. So David thinks of how he can cover up the sin. Maybe if her husband came home, they would think that it was his child. So he sends to Joab to make Uriah come back, and Uriah is sent back. When he gets there, David promises in verse 12, Uriah, I'll send you back to battle, which is where Uriah knows that he ought to be. By the way, he will not go be with his wife, so that cover-up did not work as David intended. In verse 14, Uriah is sent back along with instructions on how he can be eliminated. In verse 18, once that deed is done, the news is sent back to David. In verse 22, the messenger then sent, shows David everything that has taken place. The chapter closes with Bathsheba mourning for an appropriate period, and then in the last verse, David sends for Bathsheba and brings her into his home. I have children. Maybe you have children or no kids. You've watched them. When it's too quiet in the house, you start thinking, maybe I should look and see what's going on. And there may be all these things happening. Shh. We're busy, but we don't want mom and dad to find out. That is the very image that comes to my mind in this chapter. There is this action and this action, everything hidden, occurring hopefully behind the scenes in their mind. But notice the first verse of chapter 12, the very first line. The Bible says, then God sent Nathan to David. That is like the parent stepping in and saying, enough. We're not talking about children in this chapter. We're talking about people who should have known better and should have comported themselves better. The study of the word send in this chapter culminates with God having the final say-so as he sent Nathan to say, thou art the man. So here's one word that is carrying us through this entire terrible story, about which David would lament for many years, I'm sure, to come, and about which he would later write, for example, Psalm 51 and Psalm 32. Tomorrow morning, my intention is to look at similar examples drawn from the New Testament, probably in the end be more valuable as we continue to share the gospel. But I hope that you'll think about how word studies can be important in your preaching and teaching as well. If you have questions or anything like that, I'd be more than happy to visit further. I thank you for your kind attention today.